There was no smile on any face when daylight brought a clear view of the yard and surrounding country. My mother's first glance out of the window showed a little dead Negro child, its body entangled in the debris in the yard. Though she and all of us became familiar with a sight of violent death in the next few hours, to her, that still small brown fawn epitomized the storm. There was little talk. All were stunned by the catastrophe that had overtaken them. They gazed in silence at the devastation. Along the road, they saw a bicycle stuck up in the mud, and sitting jauntily on it, hat on head and cigar in mouth, was a dead Negro man. Clearly, death had caught him unaware. Closer into town, they saw an overturned cabinet, and on the top shelf, wrapped in a quilt, the lifeless form of a boy of about 3 years. And most poignant of all, a nun with several children tied to her body.
That was Catherine Vetters Paul from an oral history used here courtesy of the Rosenberg Library in Galveston. She survived the storm with her family and remembers the utter devastation in town. We'll hear more from her later. Founded in 1839 on Galveston Island, the city of Galveston was a thriving seaport community. In 1899, Galveston was the biggest cotton port in the country and the third busiest overall. 45 steamship lines served the city, among them the White Star Line connecting Europe to Galveston. By 1900, it was the fourth largest city in Texas and one of the wealthiest in the country. On September 8, 1900, the deadliest natural disaster in American history occurred when one of the worst Atlantic hurricanes hit Galveston. The Category 4 storm surge was between 8 and 15 feet high. Wind speeds were estimated at up to 135 miles per hour. Residents had very little warning, and the destruction of the bridges and telegraph lines made evacuation to and communication with the mainland impossible. The following day, messengers took a surviving ship to Houston to report on the disaster and to request aid. While at first their estimate of 500 dead was considered an exaggeration, soon the magnitude of the tragedy would become clear. Though the total number of casualties is unknown, estimates range from 6,000 to 12,000.
The ship that was anchored in Bolivar Roads, some of the seamen said afterwards that they counted like 30, 40 bodies in the water. And one seaman said that they found a young girl whose hair got snagged in the anchor chain. And the man said, it is enough to give up the sea, experiencing something like that.
I'm Amy Bachari, and you're listening to Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. Through recording, preserving, and educating, our mission is to share the impact of engine-powered vessels, their crews, and their passengers with future generations. Learn more at sshsa.org. Today, I'm joined by Eric Pearson from Friendswood, Texas. He's the author of a recent two-part article in our Powerships magazine that details the vessels that encountered the 1900 storm, from the first sighting to the Caribbean and after Galveston when damage reached as far as the Great Lakes in Canada. If you don't know, Powerships is a quarterly magazine published continually since 1940 when it was called the Steamboat Bill of Facts. Each issue is produced in full color and packed with exciting and informative features on maritime subjects that bring the past to life. This 88-page magazine includes regional columns from across the United States and overseas, special columns on cruise ships, yachts, tugboats, reviews of newly published maritime books, and much more. Visit sshsa.org/shop to purchase single issues or join our organization, support our mission, and receive Powerships free as a member benefit. You can learn more at sshsa.org/join. The first question I had for you was just if you could tell us a little bit about your background in history and why you're interested in writing about the topic of the 1900 storm for Powerships.
Well, my background is really dealing with computers and information technology. I worked for the Johnson Spacecraft Center for 36 years as a programmer, 18 years with a company called Computer Sciences Corporation. And then the following 18 years, I worked for a company called Sciences Application International Corporation. And we supported NASA's aircraft maintenance, aircraft logistics, flight scheduling, software applications. So I wasn't directly involved in the maritime industry, you know, in my working background, but my father and my grandfather were both seamen. My dad was a ship captain with American Export Lines out of New York during the war. And then after the war, he sailed with Leitch Brothers Steamship Company out of Galveston and Houston until 1958, when he became a Houston Ship Channel pilot. And then he retired in 1986 after walking up and down gangplanks for about 50 years. So, and I made some trips with him down the channel when he was a pilot. So I'm real familiar with that. My grandfather, my dad's dad, came from Norway. He was a sailing ship captain, and his ship would go to Galveston at the end of the 1800s, toward the end of the 1800s. He actually came ashore in Galveston right around the time period when the 1900 storm hit. He wasn't, I don't think he was actually in the storm, but he came ashore and became a U.S. citizen in 1901, settled in Louisiana, he and several other Scandinavian seamen started a small shipping company. He sailed schooners from Lake Charles to Galveston to other ports along the Gulf Coast in Mexico. But I remember my dad telling me that my grandfather remembered vessels being swept inland after the storm hit and could never be refloated. They were cut up, you know, 10 miles inland. And how devastating that was. So I'm sure he witnessed a lot of the devastation after the storm. I was real young when he passed away, so I didn't have a chance to, you know, I didn't really know what kind of questions to ask. I wish I could today. I'd love to have asked him these questions today. But anyway, that's another reason why I wanted to write about vessels that encountered the 1900 storm, is because most of the books, they talk about the devastation on the island and the loss of life and the buildings. But I always wondered about the ships that were there at the time, because Galveston was a huge seaport in the South. And I wondered, well, what happened to these ships? I know there were quite a few of them, but so I did a lot of research, and that's what kind of led me to want to write about specifically about the ships that were there in Galveston during the storm, but also ships that encountered the storm before it hit Galveston in the Caribbean and in the Gulf, and later on in the Great Lakes, and then along the eastern seaboard up around the Canadian maritime provinces. So my story got bigger, a little bit larger in scope.
What were the types of things Galveston was shipping at that time?
Yeah, I think Galveston was really involved in exporting cotton, lumber, grain. They had a big grain elevator there. Galveston had at the causeway, there was a railroad causeway, and they were able to transport a lot of grain and cotton by rail to the port. And then from there, they could load them on deep water ships. That's one thing that was an advantage for Galveston. They already had a deep water port, so they could load cargo much more easily. Galveston was very wealthy, very prosperous in 1900. Some quotes were saying the Strand in Galveston was known as the Wall Street of the Southwest, because of all the businesses right along Navigation Street and the Strand. And at the time, Galveston's population was even bigger than Houston. Galveston had a population, I looked it up, they had 37,000 people versus Houston only had 30,000 people. which is mind-boggling me today because of the size of Houston. But Houston really was up and coming.
Now let's move to the storm and the beginning of the storm before it got to Galveston. Can you talk a little bit about some of the vessels in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico and what they would have experienced before the storm actually hit Galveston?
The first encounter with the 1900 storm, a vessel was transiting between Cape Verde Islands and the Antilles. And they kind of dismissed it as just unsettled weather and a distant squall.
That was on Monday, August 29th, 1900. The captain noted in the ship's log that the winds were from east southeast at force 4, quote, a moderate breeze.
But the storm was really intensifying south of Cuba in the Caribbean. It crossed over Cuba. It hadn't become a Category 4 storm yet, but it damaged several sailing ships, especially around Florida Keys. When it went across Cuba, there was a German steamer called the St. George, and it ran aground in Santiago de Cuba. And the ship was a total wreck. When it crossed Cuba, came into the Gulf of Mexico, there were some other steamers that were transiting through that area. One was called the El Dorado, and it was from the Morgan Line sailing out of New Orleans. And it was encountering gale force winds and waves. And this was about 150 miles south of the Mississippi River. Then there was a steamer, Louisiana, that was with Cromwell Line. She had 30 passengers on board, and she was transiting from en route from New Orleans to New York. And she encountered 100-mile-an-hour winds and waves. The waves were high enough to where seawater was going down the ventilator shafts to the engine room and showering all the men down below with seawater. So they were experiencing some pretty intense weather. There was also reports of sailing schooners and barks that were run ashore in the Florida Keys. Cargo ships were reporting their deck loads were being washed overboard. When the storm crossed over Cuba, at that time, ships didn't have Marconi wireless communications, so they couldn't relay what they had encountered to like weather bureaus. So the Cuban forecasters predicted the storm would head toward the northwest, whereas U.S. weather forecasters said, no, it's going to cut across to, it's going to go east, cut across Florida, and go up the eastern seaboard. There was a lot of cities and ports like Galveston that didn't think there was going to be any need for warnings. You know, they didn't even expect a storm heading their way because the weather bureau said, you know, it's not going to affect you. It's going to Florida, so don't worry about it. The weather bureau, when they finally issued a red flag warning to the Galveston bureau, there were ships that had already left port. One of them was called the Pensacola, and she left thinking that oh, the weather's going to be fine, but it was like only an hour or two later after she had already left Galveston that they put up the red flag warning saying that, you know, stay in place, don't leave the harbor. You're going to run into some really bad weather.
I know there was a lot of different types of ships in Galveston at the time. There would have been schooners, there would have been ocean-going steamships. I did read somewhere that the crew members on board the steamships weathered the storm better, but do they know how many people died on ships, or there's no way of knowing?
I did research in that, and the newspaper article I found about the loss of a merchant mariner was on a Spanish ship. The name of the ship was the Telesfora, Telesfora. And she collided with another ship in the channel. When the storm hit, you had a cascading effect of all these structures on the beach side being torn up, destroyed, and ramming into the next block of homes, the next block, all the way to the bayside.
Disaster struck in the hurricane and tidal wave of September 8, 1900. On Friday afternoon, September 7th, about 5 o'clock, we all stood on a little northeast gallery off the dining room. My father had heard that day in town of a hurricane in the Gulf, and all scanned the sky for some sign of the approaching storm. It was a perfect late summer afternoon, the sky clear blue and cloudless. Periodically, the two boys ran the 5 blocks to the beach to see how much nearer the Gulf had come in. Captain Minor, closest to the beach, felt secure in the concrete retaining wall he had had constructed around his place, so planned to stay alone in his house, his family being in Virginia for the summer. His body was never found, but no one even faintly suspected the disastrous tidal wave that was so swiftly moving in from the depths of the Gulf. By 5 p.m., the tidal wave and the hurricane struck simultaneously, but in the frightening hours before darkness settled over the city, the water had come in over the tops of the 4-foot fences. The animals tried to swim to safety, and the frightened, squawking chickens were roosting everywhere they could get above the water. People from homes already demolished were beginning to drift into our house, which still stood staunchly against the increasing fury of the wind and water. Suddenly, there was a sensation such as one feels in a boat being lifted by a giant swell. The house rose, floated from its 6-foot foundation, and with a terrific jolt, settled on the ground. We children were submerged in 5 feet of water, and the soldiers, groping frantically about, finally fished all three of us out and handed us, gasping and dripping, to our mothers who had fled higher up the stairs.
You look at the photographs. There was one picture, and it was Texas City, and it was just clogged with lumber. As far as you could see. You could see one little steam, it was a steam launch, and it was riding up on top of the lumber, but it was completely clogged, and it was from all the buildings that were destroyed on the island, and it had transited over Pelican Island, had gone over toward Texas City. So the whole bay was just choked full of debris and bodies. A lot of the captains on the ships, they knew the storm was coming. They put out extra lines to secure the ship to the wharfs, but the wharfs were being destroyed. The lines broke. So these ships were adrift in the middle of the storm in the channel, and several of them collided with one another. They didn't sink, but they did a lot of damage, especially the steel-hulled ships. They did damage to the deck plates. But the fatality on the Spanish ship, she ended up colliding with a grain elevator, and the timbers from the grain elevator fell on the ship, and he was killed, a Spanish sailor. But he was the only one that I could find that died as a result of the storm. Most of these sailors on the ocean-going ships, at least they had a chance of survival. You know, I mean, it was a fairly large vessel that could, you know, they could withstand the storm a lot better than sailing ships. They had a whole bunch of yawls, bark sloops, barkentines, schooners. They had dredges. They had tugboats, barges, fishing boats, light ships. They were all damaged or sunk or completely destroyed. Some of them were pushed. There was a dredge that was pushed 10 miles inland. There was no way they could refloat it, so they had to cut it up. One of the vessels, the Kendall Castle, she was in the channel, broke loose from the wharf. And at that time, the waves, there was a storm surge of 15 to 16 feet. Winds were up to about 145 miles an hour. And the surge completely covered Pelican Island, which is on the bay side of from where the ships were anchored. There were 12 ships that were tied up to the wharfs. And let's see, there were 3 ships in quarantine. The quarantine station was on Pelican Island, and they were anchored right there by the quarantine station. There was one ship that was anchored in Bolivar Roads, which is in the channel between Galveston and the Bolivar Peninsula. So the Kendall Castle drifted over Pelican Island, went over into the bay, Galveston Bay, ended up running over a lighthouse. They never did find the lighthouse keeper. And then it ended up in Texas City, and that's about 10 miles north of Galveston. One ship crossed Galveston Bay, ended up 30 miles all the way up to the northern end of Galveston Bay. And I'm thinking that was right around Baytown area where the entrance to the Houston Ship Channel goes. So she had traveled 30 miles up Galveston Bay. The ship that was anchored in Bolivar Roads, it was a whale ship. And they were a really unique design ship. And most of the hull was underwater. But the captain decided to release both anchors. And then he had the engines running almost at full speed against the waves and the surge to keep the ship from running aground. And he succeeded. The ship made it. But some of the vessels, they ended up careening against railroad bridges. Just did a lot of damage. A lot of debris, a lot of wood everywhere. Yeah, it was just devastating. Anywhere between 6,000 and 12,000 people were killed in that storm. So it must have been a horrific scene, after the storm hit.
There was little talk. All were stunned by the catastrophe that had overtaken them. They gazed in silence at the devastation. Then Jacob cried out, "Papa, where are the peaks?" Everyone looked to the west, where their neighbor's home had stood a stone's throw away. Not a plank nor brick remained, not even a trace of the foundation. Richard Peak, his wife, 8 children, and 2 servants were gone. And to this day, their bodies have never been found. The rain and wind abated, the waters receded, and by afternoon, our family and a number of others decided to attempt to make their way into town, our group to my grandparents and aunts on Broadway. The horrors of that trip are almost indescribable. Once my parents saw the pitiful form of a little 12-year-old girl entangled in a barbed wire fence, their minds became numb to the horrors, and they stumbled on in silence.
And then after it, the damage hit Galveston, the storm continued through the Midwest, damaging farms and crops and livestock. And then it went into the Great Lakes and did a lot of damage in the Great Lakes. There was a three-masted sailing schooner called the Penobscot, and all of her masts were wiped clean. And then there was a schooner called the PB Lock. She was carrying pig iron. She was hit by 60-mile-an-hour winds. The storm had lost its intensity once it crossed over Galveston. It was just a tropical system. But then when it got over the Great Lakes, it started re-intensifying again. So it really hit sailing ships hard in the Great Lakes. And there was a couple of steamers. There was a lot of iron ore carriers up there too that encountered the storm. One steamer called the John B. Lyon was carrying iron ore, and she capsized on Lake Erie, killed 16 crew members. I think there was one survivor. Then there was a schooner called the Dundee. She sank on Lake Erie, killing one crew member. There was a steamboat called the City of Erie that left Buffalo with 300 passengers. And she encountered huge waves that damaged the upper works on the vessel. There was a steamer called the Nymec. She had her deckhouse washed away. Another steamer called the Iroquois ran aground. So you had all these vessels that were running aground, experiencing really, really high winds and waves. The storm made its way up along the St. Lawrence Seaway, and did a lot of damage in homes and structures from Buffalo all the way to New York City. They had homes with windows shattered, roofs blown off, chimneys that collapsed, trees falling down on telegraph lines, telephone lines. Then the storm made its way out along the Canadian Maritime provinces that did a lot of damage to fishing vessels, and there were several fishermen that were killed. It finally died off the coast of Newfoundland, but it did a lot of damage to vessels all along the Caribbean, the Gulf of Mexico, into the Great Lakes, and through Canada and then out to the North Atlantic.
Yeah, that I think was the most interesting part of your article for me, because I think when people think about the storm, you hear about Galveston because there was so much devastation there, but you don't realize that in fact it continued on and kept causing problems elsewhere in the country. And I know, I mean, I had read Eric Larson's book, Isaac Storm. And sort of about the perspective of the Weather Bureau and predicting and all of that. But I guess I have one question that I actually didn't put on the list, but as you were talking, I was thinking about, which is once it hit Galveston, and now I guess the US Weather Bureau is sort of like, oops, we were wrong, and the storm continued on. Was there any warning to those in the Great Lakes? Would they have known it was coming, or would they have assumed it by that time it would have died off?
Not that I'm aware of. They certainly knew the storm was moving through the Midwest, but as far as I found, that there wasn't a lot of warnings set in place before the storm hit. I think they knew it was coming, but they didn't know how severe it was going to be, especially when it started to re-intensify over the Great Lakes. So it was kind of a work in progress all over again. Winds were picking up. Strong winds were picking up in like Detroit, at the far western side of the Great Lakes. So they didn't really have an idea that it was going to be that bad. Even people in New York City said they were hoping that they weren't going to have another Galveston's type of storm, knocking at their door.
Houston was kind of just up and coming at that time, and you talked about the ship channel.
I think a lot of people think that Houston really, the ship channel started after the 1900 storm, but it actually started back in the 1860s. The city of Houston, they realized that they needed a link to the sea. At the time when Houston started, it was just a bayou with lots of vegetation and very shallow creeks and rivers.
Augustus Chapman Allen and John Kirby Allen came to Texas from New York in 1832 by way of Galveston to make their fortunes through land speculation. The brothers purchased 6,642 acres of land at the junction of Buffalo Bayou and White Oak Bayou and named their fledgling town Houston after General Sam Houston, the hero of the Battle of San Jacinto, who led Texas to independence from Mexico. The Allen brothers' marketing skills soon led to Houston's population boom, which rose rapidly from approximately 200 residents in 1832 to an astounding 2,073 by 1836. On August 30th, 1836, they ran an ad in the Telegraph and in the Texas Register to entice immigration, stating that the grassland on the coastal plain would become, quote, "the greatest interior commercial emporium of Texas," end quote, and that ships from the Northeast to New Orleans could sail up Buffalo Bayou. Their ad described a future for Houston they hoped to achieve, but it did not match the present reality. In fact, it wouldn't be until the following year, in January 1837, that Captain Thomas Wigg Grayson would guide the small paddle wheel steamer Laura from Galveston to Houston, marking the first time that Buffalo Bayou was fully navigated to the then makeshift town of Houston. At that point, Galveston was on top.
So the city of Houston formed the Buffalo Bayou Ship Channel Company that worked alongside the Army Corps of Engineers to start dredging Buffalo Bayou all the way down to Galveston Bay. That started before the 1900 storm. There was a big bond election in 1912 that started a lot more dredging.
While Galveston was rebuilding, Houston was working toward its deep water port.
Initially, a lot of the shallow draft schooners and barges would go all the way up to almost the center of downtown Houston at Allen's Landing. But when they started dredging the channel out, they had a turning basin that they dug up along Clinton Drive, which is several miles further south of where Allen's Landing was. From there, they were able to dredge it out deep enough for deep water ships to come into the turning basin. And they completed that in November 1914. And they had a formal grand opening. I think even President Woodrow Wilson, he pushed a button in the White House, and somehow that was linked to a cannon in Houston that fired off a cannon. So that was the initiation of the Port of Houston. But they've been doing constant dredging ever since the channel was first dug out. That's pretty much what it was like, for Galveston, the competition between Galveston and Houston. Houston was very prosperous. It was starting to get prosperous. It was a major hub for rail. And when you can link up the rail with a deep water port, then that's a formula for success. But there were two events I think that really helped expand the ship channel. One of them was Spindletop. Oil was discovered in Beaumont at Spindletop in 1901. And that had a huge influence on the petrochemical industry in the ship channel, because then they started building refineries to refine gasoline. Combustion engines were starting to be built, and then you had World War I that also created a need for more gasoline, for engines, for automobiles, tanks, motorcycles, airplanes. It just the demand grew. Baytown, Humble Oil's Baytown refinery, it opened up in 1919, and that was kind of like one of eight different refineries that were established along the ship channel. Yeah, by 1930, I think it was, they had eight refineries. The second event besides Spindletop was World War II. There was the construction of two major shipbuilding shipyards on the Houston Ship Channel. One of them was the Houston Shipbuilding Company, and it was a joint venture by Henry Kaiser and Todd Shipbuilding right at the beginning of the war to build merchant ships, Liberty cargo ships. One of those ships my dad was captain of, it was the Thomas Eakins. She was launched in 1944. So I wrote a paper about that, and I wish my dad had was still alive, where I could have shown him some of the information I found about his ship. But that created a whole bunch of jobs, along with another shipyard, the Brown Shipbuilding Company, that was established by Brown and Root. And Brown and Root, they had just built the huge Corpus Christi Naval Air Station, and the Navy was very impressed with what their capabilities were. So they asked them if they'd be interested in building submarine chasers. And Brown and Root had this can-do attitude that as long as they had the right personnel, they could build anything. So they started building submarine chasers, and they'd never built a vessel ever in their history. Then they started building destroyer escorts, and then even some tankers at the end of the war. But both of these shipyards employed more people during the war in Houston than any other industry, wartime industry. And in the process, they took all of these untrained people from all walks of life, and they became painters, electricians, welders, boilermakers, machinists, carpenters, pipe fitters, draftsmen, all kinds of industrial roles. So that after World War II, Houston was really, it had a lot of qualified people with a skill set to build more refineries. Brown and Root, the Brown Shipbuilding Company, ended up building the first drilling rigs after the war. So there was a lot of industrial work done during the war, construction during the war that caused a big economic boom for Houston. So that was pretty much how Houston kind of came out on top, and the ship channel in the process.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to have a chat with me.
Oh, you bet.
I hope you enjoyed hearing about the history of the 1900 storm through Rosenberg Library's oral history with survivor Catherine Vetters Paul, and about the vessels impacted by Powerships author Eric Pearson. If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving us a review. Learn more about SSHSA at sshsa.org. Until next time, fair winds and following seas.